Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Today we'll be exploring the art of wildcraft, and I'm delighted to be speaking with Lauren Kemple of Backyard Wildcraft. Lauren, can you tell us more about yourself?
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm just delighted to be able to share my love for plants and for our bioregion. I've been interested in plants my whole life, grew up playing in the woods and just always loved being around them. And then when I moved to Southern Oregon, I met the person who became my teacher, Jan Carlson, my herbalism teacher, in I think maybe 2008 or 2009, and he had the Vitalist School of Herbology. It took a while, but I eventually was able to sign up for his program and study with him for about 2 years. And it just completely, I was already interested and had some knowledge, but it completely opened my eyes to how bountiful our bioregion is and how much medicine there is available, but also just how we're meant to be in relationship with the living world in this way that I hadn't quite really recognized until then. So anyway, I studied with him for a few years, went on to teach classes here and there, and then about a year and a half ago, he actually was diagnosed with a terminal illness and asked me to take over his apothecary. So I did that, and so now I am co-owner with a former student and friend of Vitalist Botanicals, which was his bioregionally focused apothecary. So we make medicine from, I don't know, I would say probably 80% of it is from local herbs, where that's our focus. But there are of course some things that don't grow here, like ginger and turmeric and things like that are valuable medicine. So I do that, and then I love to teach and share my love for the land where we live. So I teach plant walks and medicine making classes, and I love to do craft projects too with plants and kind of everything ethnobotanical. Like I just love all the ways we can interact with them. So I make botanical inks and use them as paints and teach people how to do that and just how to capture the color from the living world. And I just love to play around with play around with plants and hang out with them and grow them and be around them and work with them. I
Neat.
don't know if that answers your question.
No, it's wonderful. Obviously, the Native Americans and earlier people didn't have pharmacies. They didn't have a CVS or a Walmart or whatever to go to pharmacies. What are some typical plants that might have been part of everyone's use, almost daily use? What did they really depend on that was kind of obvious that maybe we don't know about?
Oh gosh, well, the first thing that comes to mind for sure is acorns in this area for food. So, I mean, you would probably, I'm guessing you were asking more about medicine, but I just immediately thought of acorns because they were the primary, and for some people still are the primary food. And so one of my dear friends, Jolie Ilan, who actually has passed a few years ago, was also known as the Acorn Lady, and she got me so excited about just the amazing value of acorns and oak trees in general. But I learned from her that one valley oak, which is not a species that grows here, but it's probably pretty comparable with our white and black oaks. One valley oak can produce between 500 and 1,000 pounds of acorns during a mast year, and so that can feed two or three people for a whole year if that's like the base of their diet. And 10 ounces of acorns, I'm terrible at remembering numbers, but I want to say 10 ounces of acorns is like almost half of one's daily protein and like two-thirds of their carbohydrate and fat needs. So just nutritively, like they are dense powerhouses of nutrition. And everywhere that acorns have grown and do grow around the world, they grow circumboreally in this band around the globe. And every culture, traditional culture that has had oak trees has consumed them because they're so abundant and they're so nutritious. The native people here, like before colonizers came in, like that was their one of their staple foods. So that's what immediately comes to mind, and I just get
I'm
so
kind of
excited. I
embarrassed to
actually have.
say, yeah, I've never had an acorn. Is an acorn, can you just eat it? Can you just pick it off the ground and eat it?
I have baskets of acorns. I'm sitting by my wood stove. I have them drying all around me at the moment. No, I know. I'm glad you asked that because that is a that is the obstacle. So
Okay.
they, if you were to do that, it wouldn't hurt you, but you would probably spit it out because they're full of
Okay.
tannins. So they're really bitter and they're just not going to taste good. But those tannins are kind of protecting them. So they keep them from getting rancid and they help them last a long time. But in order for us to be able to consume them without our tummies getting upset, we have to leach them. So that's basically soaking them in water. So here's one that's already partly cracked open. So I would crack them all open. What I have been doing is I get them in my blender with water and break them up into, not like to a puree, but till they're just sort of chunky. Because the more surface area that there is, the faster they leach.
Okay.
So you put them in water in a jar and then strain the water off, multiple times a day, and it will become brown. So that's the tannins leaching out into the water. And you just keep straining that off. And once the water's clear, if you taste it and it's not bitter anymore, then they're ready to consume. And there's a lot of different techniques for doing this. One thing that I have done when I've lived right next to a creek is put them in like a mesh bag and just set them in the creek, and the running water just leaches them.
Oh.
And it actually works a lot faster than if you do it in the jar. But most people don't have access to a creek in their backyard. So that's kind of the way to do it at home. And it will take a while. I mean, sometimes depending on the type of acorn, some of them have more tannins than others. It takes sometimes a few weeks. So it's time, but it's mostly passive time,
Great.
You're in the kitchen a few times a day at least, so it's not that hard to just dump out the water and rinse them.
So I know
But
what an acorn looks like. So do all acorns kind of look alike? Like I'm not going to pick up a wrong type of nut and think it's an acorn, right?
I was thinking about this
Probably.
exact thing this morning. I was like, are there any toxic lookalikes for acorns
Right.
or any just lookalikes? Like, I don't think so. And I mean,
Okay.
no. And I mean, you're a little further north than me, but you probably have mostly white oaks up there. Do you?
I'm learning. I'm
Okay.
not sure, but yes, I'm learning. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm near Rogue River, and we have a pretty good mix of white and black oaks. And they have the really typical, both of those species have the really typical oak leaves that are deeply
Okay. All
lobed.
right.
And so even if it's winter, or fall, because that's when the acorns fall and you'd be harvesting, you can look around and see the leaves below. So even if you're not super sure, is this an oak tree? Like if there's what looks like acorns and there's the oak leaves, yeah, you're good.
Fantastic. Okay. And this sounds like probably was a Native American first food, right?
Yes,
That's
yes.
a concept I've learned since I've been out here about the first foods that we learned, the lamprey, a first food as well. So the acorns were first food. What was another Native American staple?
Well, camas, definitely. Are you familiar with that one? So it's in the lily family, and it has, so it's in the lily family. It was fields of camas were tended by Native people. And so this is one of those foods that we've learned, like, it's not an accident that there's huge fields of camas. Like, those have been deliberately tended for hundreds, maybe thousands of years by people because they were deliberately cultivating these foods. So they're in the lily family. It's the bulbs that are dug up and roasted and eaten. So it's kind of, a little bit similar to a potato. It's
Okay.
a starchy root. There is a very toxic lookalike for that one, but I made these little laminated toxic plants for classes I teach because
For an
it's,
example, yeah.
yes, for an example, because so this is called death camas, and it looks very similar, but it's white. And true camas, common camas, is bluish purple. They bloom close to the same time, and true camas can it does turn white as the flowers fade. So this is not one that I recommend people just go out and dig up. You need to visit the site like throughout the season to know for sure that what is there is common camas, that it's blooming purple, that there aren't any white death camas mixed in because they can grow side by side.
Right.
So that's a really, it's just a really important thing to learn. I feel like I'm going a little bit in a different direction now, but what I always recommend to people is that they begin, if they're interested in wildcrafting and foraging, they begin by learning the deadliest plants, you know, because
Right.
there are a lot of plants that have toxicity to some extent, but you know, plenty of them, it's like they might make you throw up if you eat too much,
Right.
which wouldn't be fun, but there are not that many that will kill you. Death camas is one of them that
One
would.
of them.
So you don't want to mess around with it. But if
Right.
you learn, I mean, I've been meaning to make a little guide for, you know, what are the most toxic plants in my area, but it's just a handful. It's like between 5 and 10 that come to mind. And so once you know those, it gives people a lot more kind of breathing room to
Right.
play because you know, okay, this is not going to kill me. It's not one of these 10 plants that will kill me. So I can experiment a little bit and
Right.
if that makes
There's so
sense.
much out there, and it's a scary thing because I interviewed a mushroom expert, and he said, yes, you have your deadly ones. He says, but more often than not, they're not. He says, but one thing he would practice, he says, you could put anything to your lip or to your tongue. He says, just don't swallow it. And he says, you'll be okay. Even if you get one of the deadly ones, if you don't swallow it, you're fine. And you know, and that's for mushrooms. I know for plants, there are different parts of the plant, clearly. The one I knew when I lived out east was a spring beauty. It was just a little flower. And you could eat the I guess the bulb part of the plant under the ground, not the roots, but like a bulb underground. You could eat that of the spring beauty, but you wouldn't necessarily eat the rest of it. So I think this is what's so frightening sometimes, is that parts of the plants are great and parts are really bad. And how does a beginner begin to figure that all out?
I know. It is overwhelming. It is overwhelming. And when I first became interested in this stuff, I didn't really have a teacher. I was using books and I just was like, well, I can identify this plant, but I don't know when to harvest it or which part to harvest it
Right.
or how to use it. It's overwhelming. And the only way to really do it is one plant at a time. One thing I do think can make it a little easier is getting to know the plant families, because there are themes. And so I just have a pile of all sorts of books right around me right now. But this book, Botany in a Day, is wonderful because it really makes it accessible. The most common plant families, it breaks them down, the patterns in them, and helps you kind of recognize, if you go through this book, it helps you start to recognize or narrow down the plant families. And then from there, it's a lot easier to identify what you're working with. So a really common, a commonly known, a pretty well-known family would be the mint family.
Right.
A lot of people know that mint plants almost always have square stems. So if you kind of rub them between your finger, so like lemon balm, peppermint, spearmint, thyme. Actually, I mean, some of the woodier ones, they kind of, you can't really identify the squareness, but like lavender and thyme and rosemary are also in that family. And it's hard to really recognize the squareness. But they also have opposite leaves. So their leaves are directly across from each other on the
Okay.
stem versus alternate.
Stair steps.
So I kind of like to have people start with the mint family because and they also are usually aromatic. So if you think about those lemon balm and peppermint and rosemary and lavender, they all have a strong smell. And that strong smell that's inherent in most of those plants usually translates into antimicrobial properties of some kind. So a lot of mint family plants are good antivirals. And it's because of those volatile oils that that you can smell that they have those properties. So
Now, we
yes.
love those. Do animals love those?
Do animals love those properties?
The
Or
mints. I know humans love them. I thought they were also some way to keep some animals away. However, that's
oh,
true.
like deer, people keep them and hope their deer won't eat them.
Yeah, maybe that's a rumor.
I think it really depends how hungry the deer are.
Okay, right.
I've lived places where the deer will even eat, rosemary if they're really
Yeah.
hungry. But yeah, they tend to not be as attracted to them.
Now my son is a forager, and
Okay.
he often makes teas. So yeah. And he makes teas out of the mint, of course, and he'll throw some blackberries in there and nettles. Now my mom is deathly allergic to nettles and gets really bad fevers and whatnot. Besides, they hurt. I mean, if you touch the wrong side of the nettle, it hurts. So I was very concerned the first time he was collecting nettles, so I thought, what's he doing? But so how does someone know if there's a plant that's I was taught to avoid? And here my son is drinking it or boiling it.
I know. It's just not black and white, is it? Is
Right.
your mom allergic to consuming nettles internally? Can she drink nettle tea?
No, we never even tried that. On her
Okay.
honeymoon, she walked into a nettle bog and she was out for the count for the whole honeymoon. So that's how we knew that.
Because the topical reaction that people get from nettles, it doesn't the I can't remember what kind of acid it is that's in those little hairs, but it's neutralized when it's cooked or heated.
Okay, all right.
So if you drink nettle tea, it sounds like you've had it, right? When your son,
From my son,
yeah.
yes, yeah.
And it doesn't sting, right?
Right.
It doesn't sting when you drink the tea or put nettles in soup or put it in food because that acid is not active anymore when it's heated.
Okay.
Well, it's like you have to, like, plants are like people. I mean, you don't just, if you want to get to know a person, if you're like, this person seems interesting, I want to be their friend, you have to kind of get to know them and who they are and their quirks and what they like and what they don't like and what kinds of things you can get away with. Like, I can never be late with this friend, but this friend doesn't care. This plant, like nettles, is one of those plants that sort of energetically, it's fierce. I think of it as kind of a boundary holder. And it if you bump into nettles, when I'm harvesting nettles, if I'm kind of not paying close attention, I will get a lot more stung than if I'm being really mindful with it. And that sounds
How do you do
that's
that? How do you pick it without getting stung?
I still usually use gloves, but if I just want to pick one leaf, I can pick one leaf without getting stung. And I actually, my kids, I used to have them do that too. Just, I, this sounds out there, but there's so much research now about plant intelligence and plant communication. If you talk to it and are respectful and basically ask permission to harvest it and kind of and listen to whether it's receptive or not, then you can pick a leaf. I mean, I've had many experiences picking nettle leaves and not getting stung. I've known many herbalists who do that too, but it's so much about our mindset and our intention when we're with the plants, and we really have to interact with them as if, like, we have to respect them as living beings. They're not the same as us. They don't have the same kind of consciousness, but they are alive. And so they're we have to if I have so many experiences of if we are in a place of respecting them, then our experience with them is different. The medicine we make from them is different. And then, that translates into just caring for the land in a different way, because I feel like if we're able to listen to what, to at least try to listen and have the intention to listen to what the plants want and need, then we can take care of them better. We can notice, oh, this little area is always dry. Like, I need to change the irrigation over here. Or if it's a wild spot, this plant looks like it's like, there are some places where I go back and wildcraft every year. And if I, when I'm there, I try to replant the seeds. If I'm, digging up a root of a plant, I try to also take the seeds and plant them around so that they will grow back, and so that it's not just a taking, but it's also a giving, and it's a more of a reciprocal relationship with the place.
This
I'm
is
going
so
all over,
fascinating.
aren't I? I just
No,
saw
this is great because I picture myself as a young kid going fishing, and that's what I was doing. I was getting to the good hole with a good little brookie trout, and I was just rudely stomping through the nettles, quite frankly, as I was headed for the fishing hole. And so I can imagine from how you're explaining, I didn't even notice the nettles. They were just in my way, and I was just pushing through them. So that simply wasn't approaching them with respect. I had no idea they were there, really. So that's a cool concept to think about.
Well, and I think, even if you still get stung a little bit, I bet you only had to do that a few times before you learned, oh, these are nettles and I have to be careful of them. And so they're teachers in that way. It taught me to slow down and not just tromp through them. The same way that I feel like poison oak it kind of is a protector of the forest. It's like, I have so much poison oak on the land where I live, so I have to be careful of every single step if I don't want to get a rash. And just and in being careful of every single step, I'm paying more attention to the place where I am and not just spacing out and thinking about what's for dinner. It's like, okay, I have to be present with this place.
Well, there's another plant that I'm asked about a lot, and I will mispronounce it, but I think it's a family Usnea or something. It's so it's not a plant, it's a lichen. Can you tell us about that? What do you know about that?
So excited you brought up Usnea because I have a sample right here. Usnea. So this is a whole, there's multiple
Little
different
lichen.
lichens on this stick, but I'll pull off a little Usnea. Picked a few things that were growing on the ground. So Usnea is a lichen, which is basically a symbiotic relationship between plants, fungi, and they now discovered bacteria also is a component in them. And so Usnea has a little, I think it's called a phthalis. If you pull this apart, you can see there's that little white cord inside. So that's how you can identify that this is Usnea, because there's some that look similar. It's almost like a little electric, I'm not electric, elastic, little elastic cord inside of it. So Usnea, my understanding is that Usnea was up with penicillin in the running to be the first mass-produced antibiotic. And it is potent antibiotic, antimicrobial. It's a lichen, so the extraction and the utilization of it is a little more complicated because those compounds, I mean, this is getting into like medicine making, I guess, but different compounds or constituents in plants and lichens and fungus too are soluble in different mediums. So when you think of a tea, if you make mint tea, you're extracting the flavor and the constituents of the tea into the water. So water would be the menstruum or the solvent. But for lichens, they need a combination of water and alcohol to extract all like the spectrum of constituents. So it's kind of a double extraction. It's a little more complicated than just making a tea or a tincture. Although, if you're out in a first aid survival situation and you get a big wound and you don't have any antibiotics and you need something, just smushing up Usnea and putting it in there would be a really helpful way to go to prevent infection. But if you were wanting to really affect like m most effectively extract the medicine, you'd want to do a more complex extraction.
But it sounds like it could even be used for bandaging because it's so thick. To stop the bleeding, would that be something or not? To stop the bleeding and maybe the antiseptic on your wound.
It's definitely antiseptic. I don't know that it stops the bleeding. I mean, again, I don't know everything. I've only used it and known it for its antibiotic properties. There are other herbs, like yarrow is another really amazing first aid plant, and that's super common. I bet most people have that growing in their yard, and it also grows It grows everywhere. It grows near the ocean. It grows in alpine, mountains. It grows in disturbed areas. It grows in wild, undisturbed places. Yarrow's everywhere, and it is hemostatic, so it will slow the blood flow, and it's antimicrobial, and it's somewhat analgesic too. So that's an amazing one because it'll help, slow the blood flow, reduce pain, and prevent infection all in one. But
Wow.
the usnea is even more powerful as an antimicrobial. So they're both great.
What was fascinating to me reading about the usnea is it needs pretty good air quality to grow. When I lived out east for so long, we didn't have any. And so when I
Oh,
come out
yeah.
here and it's all over the place, it just makes me feel good,
Yeah.
knowing that that is telling me that it's enjoying good air, so am I. And so
Yeah.
I really love that.
I was going to get on another tangent about a lichen, but
But there's another plant that I knew from out east, but I saw it in Montana also last year. So is ghost pipes. Are you familiar with those?
I haven't worked with them myself. I know about them, but
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen them in the
Well,
wild. I've
that's.
known people who have. And I know they're around here. I feel like maybe a long time ago I did, but I didn't really know what it was. But yeah, it's interesting, and that's
Those are kind of eerie ones. They're all
Yeah.
white, and they don't have the chlorophyll for the sun, and
Right.
they feed off,
Right.
they're almost mushroom-like. They feed off
Right.
plant, but they're used for medicines, I know too, but we were warned to be cautious with those.
Yes.
Tell me, there's a difference, of course, between foraging and medicine. What is a good foraging plant around here that would be easy and not so easily confused with something that might kill you? What's another source out here that you've come to love?
So foraging for food, you mean, or
Yeah.
foraging? Okay. When we talked about acorns, oh my gosh, I love, love, love the Oregon myrtle in California Bay.
Uh-huh.
Does that grow up? You're kind of near Roseburg. Are you in Roseburg?
In Roseburg, yeah.
So I'm guessing it's up there. It's actually not down very much here in the Rogue Valley, but going out towards the Illinois Valley and out towards the coast, there are a lot of them. So it's also called California Bay Laurel, Oregon Myrtle. And the leaves you can use and just as a substitute for bay leaf that you would buy in the grocery store in a spice bottle. It's related to the European species, but it's a little bit different, but it has that same flavor. But they have these little seeds that fall down in the fall, and they actually are closely related to avocados. So the fruit on the outside is it looks like an avocado, and it even kind of tastes like an avocado, but it's not really yummy like an avocado. So that's interesting. But the good part is the seed inside of that fruit. If you break off the fruit or let the fruit just sort of get mushy and come off, and you crack open the seeds, there are these little round nuts inside, and they can be roasted. And my favorite way to use them is roast them till they're really dark, almost like coffee. So roast them and then blend them with sugar or even a sugar substitute and like puree it so that it's really, really, really smooth and liquidy and thick. It takes a while. And then pour it into little molds, and they taste and let them harden, and they taste like a combination between chocolate and coffee.
Oh
I'm
my.
not kidding. Some people get disappointed because they're expecting them to taste exactly like chocolate, and they're not. But to me, they're an amazing local substitute for coffee or chocolate, and they even are slightly stimulating in the same way that coffee and chocolate are. Like, I don't think anyone studied it, but there has to be some caffeine in there because it's just a little bit of like a wake you up kind of a
Oh, that's
feeling.
crazy. Yeah.
So those are delicious, and when a tree is, I think they have cycles, mast years, kind of like oak trees, because it seems like some years they drop a lot of nuts and some years they don't. But when they drop a lot, usually there's a lot, so you can just go, find one tree and gather a lot of nuts. They're pretty acrid and bitter before they're roasted, and they can kind of irritate your gut. But once they're roasted, they're so yummy.
What about a really common tree? You know, we have our Douglas fir around here that we love. Can you get anything from a Douglas fir, for instance?
Oh my
Sometimes I
gosh.
hear about needle tea or something, but is there anything a Douglas fir?
I wish you were right here with me. I would be giving you so many samples of things because I have a
Oh no.
Douglas fir. I have a Douglas fir honey that I made.
Ooh.
I actually just put some in my tea this morning. So the Douglas fir needles are really high in vitamin C, and
Ah.
they have the fir and the bark and the resin all have some properties that help with coughs. So you can make a tea out of the needles. I've made a tincture, which is an alcohol extract, and it's just mostly just yummy. I mean, it would also be helpful for cough, like helping to clear kind of stuck mucus in the lungs, but it's mostly just really yummy. But this honey that I made, it's so good. I have to make more this year because all I did was take the young tips and just chop them up pretty fine and put them in honey for, I don't know, a few, 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, and then strained out the tips, the little fir needle tips. And you could even eat those or make a tea with the leftover needles. And then the honey itself, it's just like lemony, sort of citrusy, but sort of piney. It's got that fir flavor, which is so yummy.
Oh, neat. So when you say that the tips, like new growth or something,
Yes, yes,
I'm
yes.
trying to
Sorry.
picture it. Okay.
Yeah, the young needles, the new growth.
Could I just chew on a pine needle? Like not a
Yeah.
new growth one, but just an old
Yeah.
one, an old
Yeah.
long one?
Yeah, definitely. The younger ones just tend to taste well, they're softer and their flavor's just more bright. But yeah, sometimes when I'm out, I nibble on the old ones,
Oh, neat. I want to go out and do this now. All right. Does that
Yeah.
work for all the pine trees around here? Like I know we have something like a sugar something, a sugar pine or
Oh, sugar
something.
pines are so
We have
fun.
cedar, like aromatic cedar or something like that.
Incense cedar, is that what you're
Incense,
thinking?
thank you.
Yeah, you can use any of those. The only conifer that you need to be careful of, is it even technically a conifer? It's an evergreen tree, is the yew tree. So
Okay.
yew trees have little short needles and they look similar to redwoods, but they are toxic. And I'm not certain how toxic the needles are, but for sure the seeds inside of their fruits are pretty highly toxic. So you have to be careful with the yew tree. Just make sure that that's not you're not eating that one. But yeah, the other firs, pines, cedars, I think the Doug fir and white fir are both particularly delicious, though, and they're so
Cool.
common. So, yeah.
And you mentioned something about their bark. Is there some way you can use the bark on the tree?
Yeah, you can use the bark. It's not, so this is kind of getting into different, the different parts of plants and when and how to use them. So, the bark has those properties that I was talking about that would kind of help break up stuck mucus in the lungs. So you could make a tea, but I tend to, if other parts of a plant can be used, I tend to use the part that's going to harm the plant the least.
Right. Okay.
One, think about that. It's going to harm the plant less to use the needles than if you just scrape off a chunk of bark. But if there's a branch that's fallen and there's bark right there, then that's how I would probably utilize the bark. It's not a medicine that I actually have ever used. It's just I know it is used in that way, and this is just part of wildcrafting for medicine or food is really just like thinking about how to cause the least harm. Like you were saying earlier, there different parts of the plant have different properties, and some parts are maybe poisonous and other parts are not. So we really do have to look at each individual plant and think like, how do I cause the least harm and still get the value that I need, if that
Right.
makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I'm picturing my backyard right now. Tell me about the Madrone. Is there anything I should
Oh,
know about the Madrone?
Madrone's so special. Gosh, it's one of the trees that made me fall in love with this area. Well, the leaves can be used, the leaves of Madrone and Manzanita can be used topically for poison oak. They're really astringent, so they help
Okay.
kind of tonify and tighten up tissues. So if somebody has poison oak rash and it's kind of in that oozy, leaky
Yeah.
phase where it's just yucky, using like making a tea from that and using it as a wash topically can help. They can be used in postpartum sitz baths for moms who are, recovering from childbirth. It can just help kind of tonify those tissues just after all that, after labor has happened. What else? The berries are edible. I don't think personally that they taste great, but they can be mixed with something else and made, into jam. I do love the flavor of manzanita berries, though. The texture's a little weird. Have you tried them?
No, I haven't.
So, yeah, so they're edible on both manzanita and madrone, but they're very different. They both have weird textures, but the manzanita, they're really dry. It's like they almost come off the bush without any moisture. Like they're just, you don't even have to dry them, really. They're almost just dry straight off the plant. But if you let them sit out in a box or a basket for a day or two to fully dry, and then put them in a mortar and pestle, sort of grind them up, and then sift out the little bits of the, what's it called? The skins, the outer skin part, and the seeds. And the stuff that comes out, the powdery stuff at the bottom, you can use as a sugar replacement because it's really sweet. So that's fun. Or, you could make jams or jellies out of madrone. Manzanita, they're so dry. I'm not sure how you could do that. But another thing I do love to do with madrone is string them into necklaces. Have you seen people do that?
No,
So,
with the berries.
yeah, this is not food or medicine, but it's just a beautiful thing. So it can be made into necklaces or garlands to hang. If you gather the berries when they're still fresh and string them and just let them hang, they'll dry and basically become these little beads. So it's a fun
Neat.
activity to do with kids and a fun thing
Yeah.
to just kind of bring the outside in to your home. The bark of madrone can be used to make a dye. It's got kind of a yellowish, orangey red, depending on how it's heated. So it can make a nice, beautiful color, dye or ink. That's kind of all that's coming to mind for those.
Well, tell me about the ethics of harvesting. Is there are there certain practices that you maintain or what you'd recommend? It's a big deal out east that people will go harvest an area and wipe out everything.
Yeah. I think that's kind of the one of the very most important things to think about when you're going into this. So
What are best practices?
I have a piece here from Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote Braiding Sweetgrass. I don't know if you're familiar with that book. She's a botanist and she's a member of the Potawatomi Nation, and she is amazing. I love her work. She wrote Braiding Sweetgrass and Gathering Moss, and she just writes about ecology in such a beautiful way that kind of weaves in poetry and science and her indigenous heritage too. So she wrote this article called The Honorable Harvest in 2015, and I mean, I've kind of used these principles myself, but when I found this, I was like, this is what it is. So what she calls the honorable harvest is a practice both ancient and urgent, applies to every exchange between people and the earth. Its protocol is not written down, but if it were, it would look something like this. Ask permission of the ones whose lives you seek and abide by the answer. Never take the first and never take the last. So That's a really important thing. Like you're saying, there are plants that have been decimated because people get in this kind of greed mentality and think, oh, this is here for me to use. And really, it's like, no, we're not entitled to take this. Like, if we're going to be using it, we need to be really doing it with care and respect and caution. So if there's a plant that I'm wanting to harvest or even needing to harvest, and there's only a small amount of it, I just don't do it. You know, it's not, unless it's something that I know is invasive or abundant. You know, if it's dandelion and I only have four dandelions in my yard, it's okay. I trust that there's going to be more dandelions or something like nettle. So it's this, you know, it's this again is where you really need to just get to know each plant and know what the impact is going to be, because every plant population's different. Some plants take 7 years to bloom. Some plants, you know, you can cut them back and they'll be blooming again the next day. So never take the first, never take the last. Harvest in a way that minimizes harm. Take only what you need and leave some for others. So I feel like this is one thing that often people who are just getting into foraging, including when I was just beginning, like it's hard. You get so excited and you're like, oh, I found something that I can use. And so you make a whole quart of you know, horsetail tincture, but without thinking, oh, do I really need this? Do I know other people who need it? Like, even if it's an abundant plant like horsetail that isn't going to be impacted by harvesting, really, it's like, is there still a need for it? Only take what you need, and leave some for others, including the wild plants or the wild, you know, animals.
Well then.
Use everything that you take. Take only that which is given to you. So again, that's the permission part. And I know it sounds weird in some ways to ask a plant for permission, but it's like, again, like they are living things, and we want to respect the land that we're living on. We need to start acting like it's a living, you know, the things on it are living things too, that we are wild. We are made of these plants. We are animals, and we're not so separate. So share, take only that was just given to you. Share it as the earth has shared with you. So yeah, I feel like even in my apothecary, you know, one of our values is to make the medicine accessible. If somebody can't afford to pay for it, then we work something out. Like, this is, you know, it's not just about us, it's about these plants and getting them out into the places where they're needed and where they can serve, not just sitting on the shelf and taking up space. Be grateful, reciprocate the gift. So in terms of foraging and wildcrafting, it's like being attuned to the land and where these things are growing and what we can do. You know, maybe everything's looking actually really happy and vital. So maybe the only thing that we can really do is like bring our joy to that place and sing a song and say thank you. And it's not always a really tangible gift of reciprocity that we have to leave, but it's like, what can we do in this moment to bring that circle of reciprocity in? Sustain the ones who sustain you, and the earth will last forever. So that's what she said. And I would love, if you're okay with it, to read this one paragraph. Do we have time? Okay.
Absolutely.
This is Robin Wall Kimmerer in that same article where she made those bullet points about the honorable harvest. She says, "What if the honorable harvest were the law of the land, and humans, not just plants and animals, fulfilled the purpose of supporting the lives of others? What would the world look like if a developer, poised to convert a meadow to a shopping mall, had first to ask permission of the meadowlarks and the goldenrod, and to abide by their answer. What if we fill our shopping baskets with only that which is needed and give something back in return? How can we reciprocate the gifts of the earth? In gratitude, in ceremony, through acts of practical reverence and land stewardship, in fierce defense of the places we love, in art, in science, in song, in gardens, in children, in ballots, in stories of renewal, in creative resistance, in how we spend our money and our precious lives, by refusing to be complicit with the forces of ecological destruction. Whatever our gift, we are called to give it and dance for the renewal of the world. So I really love her writing so much. I can't recommend it highly enough.
I love it. And I love what you mentioned. You mentioned a couple things. You said, I forget which plant it was, maybe nettles, I can't remember. How when you took that plant, you also spread some seeds, or you helped it spread seeds. One of the plants you had mentioned, you spread some seeds after you cut it or took a leaf or whatnot. And also, we used to have a problem with people when they need a piece of the plant, they just would grab the whole plant. They, pull it up by its roots. That was a big problem out east, I remember. They would just they needed a leaf, and they just, in their hurry, they would just, yank the whole plant out, and then I guess processed it at home. I think that's similar to when people process a deer, and just take the antlers and leave the deer, the rest of it.
It's a very it's a very real thing. And I mean, honestly, some days there are some days where I'm like, am I doing the right thing by sharing this with people? Because there is that potential for damage, you know? It's really real. It's very real and it happens. But I keep coming back to one of the first things my teacher said when I on our first field trip was, the forest misses us and longs for us to come back to it. And so just that way in which we are animals, in our essence, in our body, like we are made of this place. And if we there's this kind of spectrum of like just feeling entitled and going and consuming whatever we want. And then there's this opposite of that, which is being so hands off that we don't touch anything, and we, don't even like protect nature, but keep humans out of it. And I feel like we have to do this delicate balance in the middle of how do we engage with the land in a way that helps us to love it even more and care for it even more, and make our help ourselves and our communities be healthier. Like if we're eating wild food, just that in itself is giving us more nutrition than getting stuff off of the shelf at Safeway and using medicine that is in our backyard to increase our vitality. And there are ways that we can engage with the plant world that increase the health of our ecosystem and increase our health and support each other. And we just have to keep asking those questions, like, what causes the least harm? Like, is like, even if I really want to harvest this thing today, like, is this the right time? And really paying attention and honoring the answer that you get, because maybe it's not the right plant. Maybe this is not the right stand of whatever it is that you want to harvest. Maybe this one just needs a couple more years to grow until it's ready. And really respecting that, which is hard in our culture, but I think it's constantly listening to learning to listen to the land, I guess.
I do remember when I learned about the spring beauties, that you could eat the bulb, but you had to pull the plant to do so. So the plant had to die for you to eat. And that bulb was a tiny little thing, like it's like a tiny, tiny little pea. So was it worth it just for the thrill of being able to eat something while you're out there fishing? You know, was it
Right.
worth it? I tried it once, and then every time since I've thought, I don't need to do that.
Yeah. And
What's it?
it's wonderful that you got that experience in your body. I mean, it probably helped connect you to that place. And now you've always known that plant. And but you also, you know, you don't need to take all of it. You can leave the rest of it.
Yeah. What's another plant that we're free? What about skunk cabbage? Is that used for anything out here?
Oh.
I've seen a lot of
Oh.
skunk cabbage.
Do you see a lot of skunk cabbage where you live?
Not exactly where I live, but when I go to the coast.
Oh, when you go to the coast.
And of
Okay.
course, it's the first plant out after winter, at least out east it is. It's the first one that comes out because it
Oh,
has its
really?
heat, its heat properties. So it comes out first to attract pollinators.
It's
That
interesting you are asking about that because I was just talking to my business partner and my teacher used to make tincture from that, but we're out, so we were discussing whether we want to make more. And I don't really see it where I live. It's too dry. But where I
Yeah,
grew
it
up
is.
further north, like near Portland, there was a lot of it. I know it is used medicinally, but I honestly can't remember the uses, and I haven't had a call for it or a need. It does have uses, I just don't recall what they are.
Another one I wanted to ask you, are there any specific plants that are very useful for something, whether to be eaten or used for medicine, that are actually threatened or endangered? That we should acknowledge that they are useful for something, but leave them alone because of their status. Even though we know we can use them, should we?
Oh,
Because
yeah, definitely. So, one that comes to mind is white sage, which grows in California, not really here. It's further south, but that's commonly used mostly like for an incense, but that's been really over harvested. And so, actually, I work part time at Oshala Farm in the Applegate, and we cultivate white sage there because it is such a useful medicine, but the wild populations are at risk, and because it's just been over harvested. So it's one thing that can be, if you want to use it, look for cultivated or grow your own instead of buying wildcrafted or going and wildcrafting it yourself. So that's one that comes to mind.
What is it used for? I know people say they burn it, but why?
It cleanses the air. It's antiviral, it's antimicrobial. It can be used internally, but I actually haven't really worked with it that way myself, so I'm not really remembering. But yeah, it's mostly used kind of as an incense, really highly antiviral. Golden seal, well, you know, golden seal is a place, actually, just to get more directly to the answer is United Plant Savers is an amazing organization
Okay.
that has a list of like at-risk plants, at-risk medicinal plants that have been over-harvested and that basically we should really not be wildcrafting. So I can't remember, you know, how many things they have on there, but it's like golden seal and I think certain areas, black cohosh and blue cohosh and ginsengs and false unicorn root is a plant that grows in the south, not here, but is helpful for preventing miscarriage. It's really specific for that, but it's really over harvested and it's at risk. So there aren't a ton of plants around here that come to mind.
Tell me that website again. Warned you which plants to avoid. You could take
United
a
Plant
guess.
Savers.
Many plants, it was great.
But again, I would really recommend people just start with a few plants. And plants that are in your yard or in your neighborhood, and get to know them really well by identifying them, reading about them, making medicine out of them once you're really confident about the identification, learning about what parts to use and how to work with them. And so, you know, using all your senses, smelling them, tasting them, getting super familiar, and just getting to know like one by one and building on that.
Let me ask you another random question I got
Yeah,
from a
okay.
friend. Is there a plant that is very useful for doing a certain kind of thing? Let's say some kind of healing, but extremely dangerous or very dangerous if not prepared correctly. So people might know this plant for its medicinal properties of A, B, and C, but if they prepare it incorrectly, it could be quite dangerous. Is there anything we should be aware of or cautious about? For instance, eaten raw instead of boiled or something.
That's very dangerous. I mean, one thing that comes to mind is poke. So that's an invasive non-native. It's actually not terribly invasive around here, but it's non-native. And so the roots and the seeds are quite toxic
Okay.
of that one. But they also are used medicinally at low doses. And then poke, like if you've heard of poke salad, like people harvest the leaves when they're young and boil them several times, and they're edible once they're boiled. But I don't think that the leaves are super toxic if they're not boiled, but the other parts of the plant are quite toxic. So that's one that comes to
Yeah,
mind.
maybe that's what I was thinking about.
The berries are so gorgeous on that plant, so it's like one that is appealing to kids to eat because they're bright magenta and
Right.
the seeds are really toxic, so it's kind of a
Yeah.
dangerous one.
Well, which probably accounts for the color, the warming color.
Yeah.
So, if somebody wanted to get started in this, do you offer classes? Is there a way someone, a way beginner, can get started in wildcrafting?
I offer classes. So my website, I haven't actually listed any classes for this year yet, but I have a few that I'm working on getting scheduled. My website is backyardwildcraft.com, and I'm going to be offering various plant walks and medicine making classes, and probably doing some deep dives into focusing on just individual plants for a series of classes. So things like that. And I'm near Rogue River, so I know it's a little bit of a drive for people who are up in Roseburg, but I'd be interested in doing things up there too. Maybe that could happen. So yeah, I love teaching. I get really excited about just getting people out and really looking at the plants and touching them and smelling them and feeling them and cooking with them or making medicine. It just brings me so much joy.
Well,
So yeah,
we would love to have you up.
okay.
This could be really fun. We do a really fun mushroom hike, and
Oh, come on.
yeah, but we would love to have you come up and help us figure out our plants up here. That would
Yeah,
be
well,
awesome.
I love the Umpqua River. Like, I just love
Yes.
going out there. So, yeah, it would be fun to do something up there.
Magnificent, yeah.
I also want to recommend, I just actually was listening to a podcast with Scott Plous, he wrote this book, and he's in the Eugene area, I think. And he does some online classes, and he's currently working on a wildcrafting program online, and his work I feel like is really aligned with mine. He's been doing this for a lot longer than me too. He started his herbalism career in the 90s, I believe. And I was in school like 12 years ago, so I'm kind of new compared to him.
What is his book again? What is it called?
Pacific Northwest Medicinal Plants,
Well.
and his name is Scott Kloos, Kloos. And he was interviewed just in the last week or so on a podcast called The Plant Path, talking a lot about wildcrafting and his approach to wildcrafting. So he's a great resource. It is hard because with this kind of work, I feel like it's so much better doing hands-on than doing online.
Of
And we're
course,
at this
and see.
time where everything's online. And so I feel like, even if people have to start online just to start learning some of the basics, then like go out to your Native Plant Society meeting or find a class, even if it's not foraging focused, find a plant focused class and start to meet people who do know some things about medicine or food. And I would love someday, one of my dreams is to kind of create a network of Southern Oregon plant people somehow, so that people can who want to learn this can figure out how to tap into the teachers and herbalists and foragers and all these different skill sets that we have so many people doing this kind of thing around here, but if you're new, it's hard to find how to
Right.
find your way in. I wish it was a little more accessible than it is right now, but little by
Well,
little.
let me remind our listeners so they know about you. This has been an episode of Living Downstream, and I'm your host, Julie Lowe. I've been speaking with Lauren Kemple about the art of wildcraft. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any other interview in our series, you could find past episodes at umpquawatersheds.org. And thank you for listening.